before and after the murder. People in Madison, Indiana speculated about Isaac Stickley. They talked about him behind his back, wondering what was wrong with him. It's hard to say in hindsight. He tried to earn a living as a photographer. When that didn't pan out, he started building wagons, and he seemed pretty good at it. The only real fault that anybody could find was his penchant for music. He loved it. Although he was a hard worker, he enjoyed playing and listening to music so much that he'd sometimes take off work or stay out late going to concerts or dance houses. But that doesn't seem like much of an explanation. He earned a fair living, appeared happily married to his beautiful wife, and sent all four of his lovely daughters to school in a convent to ensure their proper, wholesome upbringing. But people assumed that Mr. Stickley had to bear some of the blame for what happened to his daughters. All of them, in the eyes of some. Tragically, there were rumors questioning the virtue of two of them, and the virtue of the other two was unquestionably lost. Both were unmarried and, oh my God, unchaste. Which led some people to conclude that Nellie Stickley's lifestyle was responsible for her murder. It's deplorable to me to think a woman's life is worth less because she's a sex worker. But let's be honest, that attitude still rears its very ugly head sometimes in the modern judicial system. And few people even bothered to apologize for it in the 1880s. So when Crazy Joe Payton cruelly murdered Nellie Stickley, her soiled virtue played an inevitable role in whether or not a jury would decide to send Joe Payton to the gallows or let him get away with murder. How Nellie's vocation was handled by Payton's prosecutors and his defense attorney, the renowned and infamous Thomas C. Campbell, also revealed a lot about the lawyers. Subjectively speaking, I think Payton's trial illustrates the worst elements of Tom Campbell's nature at the same time that it demonstrates his undeniable brilliance in the courtroom. And Payton's second trial revealed my favorite, most admirable trait about William Howard Taft. But those are my personal perspectives. What's undeniable is that the trials of Crazy Joe Payton for the murder of Nellie Stickley will become one more festering grievance in a building animosity between Tom Campbell and Will Taft. I'm Mike Morgan, a writer, attorney, historian, and general provocateur.
I'm Amy Morgan. I'm also an attorney, I love true crime, and I'm a bit of a political junkie. If there's history involved, well, that makes the story even better.
And this is Truth Deferred, Season 1, The National Guard Massacre. A true story about biased media, corruption, murder, a slaughter of unarmed civilians by National Guard troops, and the cover-up that followed. A cover-up which hid the truth so well that this is the first time it's being told. Some people said that Nellie Stickley was deceived by an unscrupulous young man, overwhelmed by charm and promises of eternal love. That happens sometimes. Although others just thought that Nellie Stickley liked sex. Either way, she surrendered her virginity, and somehow the town of Madison found out. And you know what happens to an attractive young woman who starts having premarital recreational sex, Amy?
She has more fun being who she wants to be?
Well, yes. Yes, she does. But in the late 1870s, there could be some pretty bad consequences as well. She is deflowered at 15, and when it becomes clear that her paramour doesn't intend to marry her, the slut-shaming starts. It's hard for a girl with a reputation like that to find an honest man in a town the size of Madison, if an honest man is what she actually wanted. So around age 17 or 18, she was either asked to move out or just decided to leave on her own. Fortunately, she had an older sister in Cincinnati, so Nellie went there to join her. It's unclear why, but she didn't immediately start living with her sister Dora. Instead, she moved into a brothel on the west side of downtown, which is where she met her new boyfriend, Joe Payton.
And did Joe ride in on a white horse to save her from herself?
No, Amy, he did not. Although it is speculated that he was her first client. That may be part of why their relationship developed into a girlfriend-boyfriend dynamic, although clearly not a typical one. She moved from the brothel where Joe met her to her sister's multi-bedroom apartment. But her sister Dora was also a sex worker and a small-scale madam, at least in the sense that she got her rent from Nellie and another tenant named Molly from what they made entertaining clients there in the apartment.
Are you saying Nellie's sister was effectively her pimp?
Sort of, but the dynamic of sex work was different in the 1800s than it is today. It was a lot more female-controlled, with almost a female empowerment bent to it. Both Dora and Nellie Stickley seem to have willfully chosen sex work. Nothing suggests that Nellie was looking for a man to rescue her from her lifestyle. The thing with Joe Payton just seems to have been fun. She was attracted to him. She had other Johns, a lot of them, as it sounds, and he saw other sex workers. It definitely wasn't Romeo and Juliet. She probably liked him because he was capable of being extremely charismatic at times, a very fun guy to be around, except when he was in one of his moody phases, when he could get really morose.
Are we talking about acting like an ordinary, pain-in-the-ass kind of mood, kind of like you get sometimes? Or are you talking about something more volatile?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for calling me moody, but I'm talking about something more volatile. I think that I'm probably talking about bipolar disorder. I'm not qualified from the psychology degree that I somehow miraculously got from Ohio University to diagnose people with mental illness. I'm definitely not qualified to do it 150 years after the fact. But with that caveat, he was pretty clearly bipolar to me. He worked in his brother's saloon as a bartender, and his brother had to fire him at least once for giving things away, including money straight out of the cash register. And he wasn't doing it out of malice for his brother. He was just being exuberantly generous. That's classic manic behavior. And these manic phases earned him the nickname Crazy Joe. But I think it was his depressive phases that were a lot more dangerous. I'm wandering into pure speculation of someone's psyche in 1878. But I think depression fed his worst impulses with Nellie. The relationship between Nellie and Joe grew in ways. They both sought each other out on the town. They went to Vine Street beer halls together. She'd hang around when he was tending bar. And at some point, she quit charging him for sex. It feels like they started having more of a dynamic of a traditional boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, except that she was still a sex worker.
I can see how that could easily get complicated.
Yeah. Some people still have those relationships, and some people are fine with them, good with them. But you have to be very secure in yourself and your person to have that kind of relationship today. And we're talking about 1878. It's a very masculine culture. There are very clear gender roles. Nellie is 18 and immature, and Joe is probably a bipolar misogynist. So he starts to get increasingly jealous. Then he buys a gun, and he starts carrying it around in his pocket, sometimes pulling it out and telling people, including Nellie and her roommate Molly, that he bought it to kill Nellie with.
Well, that's frightening. What did she do? What could she do? I mean, you can't get a restraining order in 1878.
She didn't really do anything. First, you're right, there wasn't much that she could do other than avoid him. Restraining orders didn't exist, and even if they had, she was a sex worker. Nellie and Dora and Molly lived in a large apartment that they used as a brothel, that was above a different apartment that was used as a brothel, that was a stone's throw away from a police station and within the 4th Street Financial District. So they weren't hiding. Prostitution laws were mostly ignored. But that doesn't mean that the police were going to be very helpful. But I don't think that even mattered, because I don't think she really tried to avoid him.
Now, I know there are a lot of reasons why people might stay in abusive relationships, but to me, Nellie seems like she was way more independent than most women at the time. She lived with two other women, she made her own money, and she definitely had no lack of other men in her life.
It's speculation based on what's recorded, but I don't think she was particularly scared of him. Partly, she was young, but she's also probably seen him bounce back and forth between brooding and being a really good time. Based on subsequent testimony from Molly, it seems like he was nonchalant about pulling out this gun and saying that he was going to shoot Nellie with it, quote, before any other man should have her, unquote. And he'd say that, you know, when she was taking a break from walking the streets. So it's a weird thing to say. And he'd do that, then he'd put the gun back in his pocket and he'd buy a round of beers for them. With a modern understanding of human behavior and mental illness, that's not really comforting. But I understand how a small-town young woman in 1878 might assume that he's just joking around, especially since he did it more than once.
Since I already know that she was murdered, I'm assuming he wasn't joking.
Unfortunately, he was not. Doris Stickley had seen Joe pull a revolver out of his pocket and say that he was going to kill Nellie with it. For that and other reasons, probably including the free sex and him just generally acting like a dick, she had banned Crazy Joe from her house. She was sewing in her front room one day when he came to the door and asked to see Nellie. She told him that he was not permitted inside or to see Nellie. He tells Dora that he's going to move back to Kentucky, that this is the last time he'll be around, and he just wants to say goodbye. Dora isn't having any of it. But Nellie overhears the conversation in her room, and she comes to the door. She tells Dora that she'll talk to Joe, and Dora says that if she wants to, she can talk to him, but they have to stay out in the hall. Dora then goes back to sewing, and Nellie steps out into the hallway. It's not a standard hallway. It's a wide, arcade-type hall that provides light and ventilation. And there's a window from the hall into the apartment that lets Molly see Joe and Nellie, at least out of the corner of her eye, while she's in the kitchen washing dishes. So Dora probably feels like she's kind of keeping an eye on things, protecting her sister by keeping Joe in a semi-public space. But this was not enough to keep Nellie safe. In the hall, Peyton tries to convince her to go to a brothel downstairs with him.
He's trying to take his supposed beloved to a different brothel? How romantic of him.
I mean, I'm not telling you he was Prince Charming. I assume he thought he could make arrangements to use a bed down there because Dora wasn't letting him into her place. But Nellie refused. He insisted. She refused. And he pulled out his gun, and this time he points it at her. She reaches out and tries to slap the gun away. When she does that, it goes off, but the bullet goes into a wall. Peyton then shoves Nellie back against the wall, grabs her by the throat with one hand, shoves the gun into her left breast with the other, and he shoots her. Dora instinctively screams, "My sister has been shot." She jumps up from her sewing, she throws open the door, and Nellie looks at her and says in this vacant, dreamy voice, "Joe's shot me." At first, Dora doesn't believe it. She's scared, but Nellie is standing upright, looking her back in the face, and there isn't any sign of a wound or blood. Dora turns her head and looks down the hallway and sees Peyton walking away. He's twirling his gun on his finger, and he says to nobody in particular, quote, "The damn bitch, I settled her at last."
I know how this story ends, but can I just take a minute to say, even with all my problems with capital punishment, I really hope this guy hangs.
I find that completely understandable. Nelly, as he's walking away, walks into the apartment and walks past Dora. Molly, who has been in the kitchen, rushes into the living room. She tries to take Nellie's arm because she looks a little wobbly on her feet. Nellie, who still doesn't look wounded at all or appear to be in any pain, pushes Molly away. She tells her she's fine, but she isn't fine. What none of them realize is that by shooting Nellie directly in the heart at point-blank range, all of the massive hemorrhaging that she's experiencing at this moment is going on inside her chest. She collapses. Dora calls for a doctor, and the doctor gets there very quickly. But Nellie is already dead. After Peyton leaves the building, two young boys across the street who heard the scream and the shots decide to tail him. They follow him to his brother's bar, and they lead three police officers there to him. Peyton is at the bar drinking whiskey. He tells the three cops there's no use of all this, meaning the necessity of three officers, because he admits shooting Nellie, says he intended to turn himself in. He asks if she's dead. One of the officers tells him that she is. He then goes pale. He seems to get agitated, but he tells them that he's, quote, damn glad of it. He explains that he loved her and he hopes he sees her in heaven. They haul him off. They lock him up and charge him with first-degree murder. And in jail, he repeats to reporters that he's, quote, damn glad, unquote, that he killed her.
So let me get this straight. The guy buys a gun that he says he's going to shoot Nellie with. He tells multiple witnesses that he's going to shoot her over a multiple-day period. Then in the middle of the day, without provocation, without any histrionics, he grabs her by the throat, shoots her in the heart as promised, calls her a bitch while she's dying, and he's walking away twirling the murder weapon on his finger, admits what he did, and on top of that, shows the opposite of remorse. How do you get away with this?
There's only one way, and it's named Thomas C. Campbell, undeniably one of the greatest attorneys in the United States in this era.
We ended the last episode saying that people blamed Tom Campbell for the courthouse riot and basically held him responsible for everything. Before we get there, who was he? What was he like? Was he really a villain?
I'm going to confess my own biases here in full disclosure. I've been researching Tom Campbell for over a decade, and he's a mixed bag. There are definitely personality traits that I don't like about him, and we're about to get into one of those, but there's also a lot that I admire about him. Campbell moved to Cincinnati from New York in 1866, shortly after serving in the Civil War. He came to town at age 21 with a net worth of $2.25, around 75 bucks today. He got a job as a bookkeeper in a stove store. That was fine until something happened that changed his entire life trajectory. A couple of brothers named Merrill got caught skimming from the drugstore they worked in. This was obviously a simpler time, and the extent of their long-term theft, I mean, they'd been skimming and stealing small amounts of stuff for a very long time. So it made news, and it shocked Cincinnati merchants. It sparked paranoia, and small business owners all over town started questioning whether they could trust their employees. Campbell didn't have anything to do with the Merrill brothers, but he got swept up in this. His bosses are convinced that he's been using his position as a bookkeeper to steal from them. So they have him arrested, which was a lot easier to do back then. In a preliminary hearing, the judge sees that there's no evidence to support the charges, and he dismisses the case. But the stove store guys are so adamant that Campbell has been stealing from them that they have him arrested again. And for the second time, the judge dismisses the charges as baseless. This time, Campbell fights back. He files a $10,000 false imprisonment civil suit against his former employers. Now, this is roughly the equivalent of about $330,000 today. It was an astronomical sum in an era when jury verdicts were typically very small. But the jury rules in his favor. They don't give him $10,000, but they do award him $1,500, which is almost $50,000 today. And that's probably more than he was making in a year as an entry-level bookkeeper. So all of this seems to have inspired him to go to law school. And he did that. And in 1870, Tom Campbell graduated from the Cincinnati Law School. He was also elected as the youngest member of Cincinnati City Council that same year. Before his first council term expired, he decided to run for police court prosecutor.
Police court doesn't exist anymore, but it was roughly the equivalent of what Ohio would call municipal court today. It mostly handled things like misdemeanors and arraignments. Lots of drunks and sex workers. Kind of like being, if you remember the TV show Night Court, Dan Fielding, the prosecutor on that TV show, if you're old enough for that reference.
You know, it wasn't a really glamorous job, but it was a great stepping stone. Running for the prosecutor position stirred up one of the stove store owners, and he publicly accused Campbell of embezzling again. Then, every newspaper in town endorsed his opponent. Campbell responded by suing both the stove store owner and the Cincinnati Inquirer for libel. Three pivotal things happen here. First, despite all the negative press, Campbell wins the election. Second, in exchange for dismissing the libel suit against him, the store owner writes a retraction, comically going so far to get Campbell off his back that he denies ever making the accusation in the first place. That's clearly not true, but the embezzlement allegation will never resurface. The third thing that happens is that Campbell also settles his libel suit against the Cincinnati Inquirer. He does that in exchange for a glowing apology and congratulations on becoming police court prosecutor. But something more happens here. Something behind the scenes that isn't recorded. Somehow, by suing John McLean, the primary owner of the Cincinnati Inquirer, Campbell earns McLean's respect. And they become friends, despite Campbell being an avid Republican and McLean an avid Democrat. They develop a close personal alliance, and the Inquirer starts showing a clear bias in favor of how it covers Campbell's political and legal career.
I want to point out there have been times in American history where the press tried really hard to be objective, but this was not one of those times. The bias levels were pretty comparable to cable news shows today, right?
Yeah, they were usually less cavalier about just completely fabricating facts than some outlets are today. But it was partisan as hell. There were definitely Democratic papers and Republican papers. They didn't soft pedal that, and they had direct vested financial interest in elections. If a Democrat won an election for a clerk of courts, for example, it would use the Inquirer to publish any legally required public notices, and there were a lot of them. But if a Republican won, those contracts, which were really important lucrative businesses to newspapers, that would go to a Republican newspaper, like the Commercial Gazette.
So it would have been pretty unusual for the Inquirer to support a Republican like Campbell, right?
Absolutely. And it led to a lot of animosity and accusations against Campbell and McLean. It helped tar both of them as traitors to their parties. Together, Campbell and John McLean are accused of leading the courthouse ring. What, quote, the courthouse ring is or does is pretty fuzzy. To me, the term bears some comparison to the modern phrase, the deep state, in the sense that it turns a lot of frustration with bureaucracy and unsatisfying results into a massive conspiracy that doesn't really exist. Courthouse Ring probably had more of a basis in reality. There were legitimate problems with how bail bonds were handled. The justice system seemed to move far too slowly for people of the time. And jury tampering legitimately plagued trial courts in every 19th century city across the United States. But the idea that prominent Republican and star attorney T.C. Campbell and prominent Democrat and newspaper magnate John McLean conspired to pull all the strings and levers that bogged down the justice system, produced every unsatisfying verdict, and got a little taste of every low-level kickback just defies logic. But they were a powerful alliance. And the Cincinnati Enquirer often played the role of apologist or champion for Campbell. By the time Joe Payton's saloon-owning brother hires Thomas C. Campbell, who is known more frequently as T.C. Campbell, he is a wealthy attorney. He lives in a 29-room mansion containing a library with $30,000 worth of books. That's roughly $1 million today in books. National newspapers cover his trials. And he charges a fortune because he has an incredible record of courtroom success. He's also a prominent and highly influential member of the Republican Party.
Being able to buy $1 million worth of books for your 29-room mansion is a long way from a net worth of $2.25.
And he got there by being ambitious as hell. He did some shady things. But he was also brilliant and incredibly eloquent. You can see that in Payton's first trial for Nellie's murder. But you can also see how the prosecutor screwed that trial up. He opens the case by telling the jury that Payton has committed premeditated, cold-blooded murder, which he clearly had.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume that this is an all-male jury?
Yes, it is. Which is apparently why the prosecutor couldn't leave it at cold-blooded murder. He decided to also open his case by accusing Joe Payton of robbing Nellie Stickley of her virtue. He implied that Payton had taken her virginity, then turned her into a prostitute, and, quote, shot her down like a dog when she would no longer debase herself for his gratification, unquote.
So it isn't enough that he murdered an 18-year-old young woman. The prosecutor had to make him responsible for her being a prostitute, presumably because due to the misogyny that was the prevailing attitude at the time, he doesn't think he's going to get a conviction if the jury thinks she's just a prostitute.
Correct. And in defense of a misogynistic prick of a prosecutor, Nellie's hometown Madison, Indiana newspaper wrote that, quote, news of Nellie's death caused no sympathy of feeling outside her family, unquote, because she was just a prostitute. The prosecutor was clearly no enlightened feminist, but you can see where he was coming from. Charitably, he was trying to get justice for Nellie by making her more sympathetic to this jury.
Was that the defense strategy? Make his life worth sparing because hers just wasn't worth hanging him for?
No. Campbell did take advantage of the prosecutor trying to make Nellie someone that she wasn't. At one point, he even said that consensually taking her virginity would have been worse than killing her, which reveals a level of misogyny that I do not like about T.C. Campbell. But the defense was insanity. And this is where we get into Campbell's brilliance, this insanity defense. Psychiatry was in its pre-infancy. Sigmund Freud was still in college. Psychological theory was mixed in with a lot of pseudoscience bullshit like phrenology, the belief that you can predict psychological behavior by bumps and grooves in the shape of your head, as well as eugenics, which set out a racial and ethnic hierarchy of intelligence and moral superiority. When it came to mental health, there was no clear delineation between legitimate science and complete quackery. But there was some legitimate science. Even though eugenics was racist nonsense, it was based on early understandings of genetics. And there were people, both quacks and good scientists, who believed that insanity or mental illness could be passed genetically.
So when this trial takes place, there is some rudimentary understanding of mental illness. It's just hard to distinguish what we know to be true today from what we know to be nonsense today.
Right. And Campbell's defense is a combination of both of those things. But when you look at the extremely limited and confused understanding of mental illness, Campbell's attempt to explain why Crazy Joe Payton was crazy is impressive. As a non-psychiatrist diagnosing Payton almost 150 years later, I'm confident that he was bipolar because of the information that Campbell brought out at the trial. For example, Payton's father knew absolutely nothing about making hats, but he went around the county measuring everybody's head because he was going to become a hatter. That's not rational behavior. Then, although he was completely broke, he ordered a bunch of lumber that he had no way of paying for because he was going to open a mill. And he'd sometimes leave the house, disappear, walk aimlessly without sleep for days at a time, come back to the house with his feet just bloody raw meat. Then he'd sleep for days and display what we would definitely call depressive behavior today. And Payton's grandfather displayed very similar behavior. And so did Joe as well. They brought up testimony that once, completely sober, when he was living in New Hampshire during the winter, he ran down a snowy street barefoot in the middle of the night with the plan of going to go catch fish in a frozen stream with his bare hands. Then there was the occasion that I mentioned earlier that he just started giving money away out of his brother's cash drawer. And in between events like that, he showed very clear signs of deep, deep depression, including talking a lot about suicide. So, long before psychiatry knew that bipolar disorder existed, Campbell proved that Joe Payton had it, and that it was genetic.
At this time, proving insanity would have meant proving the Manhattan test, which meant that the defense would have had the burden of proving that Joe Payton was not just mentally ill, but that he was mentally ill in a way that either prevented him from knowing what he was doing or being able to distinguish right from wrong. So I don't care how smart Campbell was. I'm calling BS on this defense. He obviously knew what he was doing because he explained it multiple times in advance. And he clearly knew that it was wrong because he went to the bar, got a drink, showed an understanding that he had killed her, admitted to it, and told police he'd planned to turn himself in. This just doesn't meet the Manhattan test as I understand it.
Agreed. But Campbell was very persuasive, Amy. The jury deliberated for 26 straight hours, and they finally told the judge that they were hopelessly deadlocked. It was a hung jury, so it becomes a mistrial. Payton is returned to county jail to await a new trial.
Wow. That's a miscarriage of justice, but I guess it's great lawyering. Today, a defense attorney would try to get Payton out on bond and delay the second trial for as long as possible in the hopes that the public would forget the ugliness of the crime. Did it work the same back then?
Not usually. Common pleas court had terms, like a legislature. It was only in session 3 times a year, and judges would usually try to make sure something got tried by the next term if it was carried over from that term. So you typically couldn't delay things that long, certainly not like today. Also, you couldn't get out on bond on a death penalty case at all. So Payton stayed locked up in county jail. But Campbell, because he's Campbell, he somehow kept getting the case pushed on to the next term of court. Payton was locked up, but that's definitely better than being hanged. And memories are starting to fade. Also, being locked up wasn't that bad for Payton, because he was a good-looking guy, and he became one of those murderer heartthrobs. Multiple women sent him flowers and gushing letters and came to see him to profess their love. What do you think about this woman, Amy?
I think there is something going on there.
Yeah, that's a phenomenon that I'm never going to fully understand.
No, me either.
But it takes a good 31 months after he shot Nellie for Peyton's second trial to finally start. The evidence in this trial is the same, but the prosecutor's different. A new county prosecutor has been elected in the intervening years, and he assigns the bulk of the responsibility in this case to his new assistant prosecutor, Will Taft.
You're talking about William Howard Taft, the former U.S. Attorney General, Secretary of War, 27th President of the United States, and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court? That guy?
Yes, that guy. But all those gigs came later. At this point, in 1881, most people just called him Will Taft. He's a 23-year-old recent graduate from the Cincinnati Law School, and this is one of his early trials. Nellie Stickley's murder is tragic, and Joe Peyton's trials are fascinating, but the real reason that we're telling this story is how it introduces us to T.C. Campbell and Will Taft, their dynamic, the state of the justice system in Cincinnati in the 1880s, and Campbell and Taft's media affiliations. So let me start with a little background on Will Taft. Will Taft is one of Alfonso and Louise Taft's kids. Alfonso Taft is an historic footnote now, but he was a really big deal in the 1880s. He co-founded the Skull and Bone Society at Yale when he was a student there, so really started the inner blue blood circle of blue bloods. As a young Yale Law graduate, he moved to Cincinnati and he became a member of city council here pretty quickly. He was also the first president of the Cincinnati Bar Association. Then he started rising in the ranks of Republican politics. He became a Superior Court judge in Cincinnati, worked on national campaigns, and then he served in President Grant's cabinet as both Secretary of War and U.S. Attorney General. And yes, I'm still talking about Alfonso Taft. You just listed off parts of William Howard Taft's resume, and Taft was also a Superior Court judge in Cincinnati, Secretary of War, and U.S. Attorney General, but he would hold those cabinet positions under Teddy Roosevelt. Alfonso served under Grant. He somehow survived all the corruption scandals of the Grant administration, and President Chester A. Arthur made him minister to Austria-Hungary in 1882, so shortly after this trial. And that job consisted of mostly hanging out with the world's richest people and a bunch of royalty and going to parties. So the Tafts, they were never the Rockefellers or the Vanderbilts. They weren't that rich, but they were wealthy. And young Will Taft wasn't young T.C. Campbell. He didn't start his career with $2.25 in his pocket. Campbell was truly a self-made man. And Taft was born into an astounding amount of privilege and connections. This disparity in backgrounds is one of the things that made these two men very different people. Taft always looked down on Campbell, thinking that he was unethical. And Campbell was morally pliable. There was a point to that. But Gilded Age politics and legal practice was really greasy. So if you're going to claw your way up from nothing to living in a 29-room mansion, in that world, you're inevitably going to make different choices than someone whose dad can introduce him to the president. But I think that the real reason that Taft had such contempt for Campbell comes from Murat Halstead. I think I'm saying his first name right. But Halstead owned and was editor of the Cincinnati Commercial, which soon changed its name to the Cincinnati Commercial Gazette around about the same time. The Commercial was the city's leading Republican newspaper, and it was the primary competitor of the Cincinnati Inquirer. It's unclear exactly how Campbell sued the Inquirer and wound up being close friends with its owner, John McLean, but it's even less clear what Campbell did to make Halstead hate him, but he definitely hated him. And during law school, Will Taft worked for the Commercial. He was a reporter covering the legal beat, which would have included all of Campbell's trials. And as he worked in this role, he and Halstead became close, lifelong friends. And Halstead seems to have passed his animosity of both Campbell and McLean on to Taft.
Now, to sort back through all these characters, we have Campbell, Halstead, and Taft. They're all politically active Republicans, and so they're all on the same side politically. But Taft, Halstead, and the Republican newspaper, they all hate T.C. Campbell and John McLean and his Democratic newspaper.
It gets complicated, and there's a lot of nuance. But for the purposes of telling and understanding the story, you can think of Taft and the Commercial Gazette on one side of a blood feud, and Campbell and the Cincinnati Enquirer on the other. I don't think either side was clearly the good guys or the bad guys. It was a mix, and there are things that I both admire and dislike about both Taft and Campbell. When Peyton's second trial starts, we see one of the things that I like most about Taft. Taft's relationship with his mother was atypical of this era, and it shaped what I think are the best parts of him. She was a college graduate and extremely smart. She spoke three languages, helped establish kindergartens, had a keen understanding of the stock market, and was as interested in politics as both her husband and her sons.
That seems like that would be pretty unusual for the 1800s.
It was very unusual for the 1800s, and it clearly shaped Taft's attitude toward women. He supported women's suffrage, and in his personal time, he was part of a mixed-gender salon with his future wife, where privileged young men and young women discussed books and debated geopolitics on seemingly at least a semi-equal basis. It was still the 1880s, so he'd probably be a sexist by modern standards, but for his era, he was an incredibly progressive feminist. And you can see that in his opening argument in Peyton's second trial. Taft tells the jury that although Nellie Stickley was a streetwalker, her virtue is not going to be litigated. Regardless of what you might think about her life choices, this trial is about her death. It's about whether Joe Peyton murdered her in cold blood. This doesn't mean that Taft didn't personally judge her, because he was pretty judgy on the whole. But he stands up for her life having value, regardless of how she made her money.
I suppose that's kind of enlightened. It's also pretty smart, because he's not going to get tripped up by trying to make her something that she wasn't. I'm guessing Campbell didn't like that.
He did not. And you can tell it from the way that he floundered and grasped at straws at the start of the trial, which was really unusual for Campbell. But then it helped him make a better case. Taft forced him to focus all of his attention on proving the insanity defense. In the first trial, he just called lay witnesses who basically said, "Yeah, we call him Crazy Joe because he's crazy." In this trial, Campbell pores over medical texts and he hires expert witnesses. It's very, very sophisticated for a 19th century trial.
For Taft to win, all he would really need to do is to prove that Peyton killed Nellie, that he intended to do it, and that he knew what he was doing. That should be simple here. For Campbell to win, he would need to meet that Manhattan standard to prove that Peyton somehow either didn't know what he was doing or that he didn't know right from wrong at the time. Even if he could prove that Peyton is suffering from some severe mental illness, that's not enough.
Yeah, the defense strategy is to argue that he suffered, quote, hallucinations and manias, unquote, that produced, quote, a homicidal tendency, unquote. And then it did so at the time that he murdered Nellie. Hallucinations and manias are different things, but the defense was conflating the two of them. If they could show that he sometimes had severe manic phases, and he pretty clearly did, it then raised the possibility that he was hallucinating, if you consider those two things part and parcel of the same symptom. So he was hallucinating, and that means that he could have been completely separated from reality when he murdered Nellie.
Even though he walked around with a gun for days, otherwise acting normal for him, and telling people that he was going to murder the girl he murdered with the gun that he said he bought for the purpose of murdering her, he didn't know what he was doing when he murdered her.
Yeah. When you say it like that, Amy, it's a virtually impossible defense. But Campbell brings in witnesses that talk about the crazy things that Peyton does, same as first trial. But this time he brings in doctors and expert testimony. We'd recognize some of it as based on legitimate science today, but a lot of it was just comical. Experts explained that insomnia and sleepwalking were known indicators of severe mental illness and madness. And my personal favorite of the testimony was that chronic masturbation helped prove that he was insane.
He masturbated so much that it caused him to kill his girlfriend.
As I said, some of the testimony was laughable. But in net, Campbell established that Peyton was some form of mentally ill. Taft called his own expert witnesses, who did a good job of arguing that even if Peyton had a couple of screws loose, professionally speaking, he still knew right from wrong. Campbell dazzled a jury with a mountain of theories, while Taft chugged along, making a very solid, logical case. Ultimately, Taft made one huge mistake. He argued it extremely well. But after it went to the jury sent out a question to the judge. They wanted to know what would happen to Peyton if they found him not guilty by reason of insanity. The judge wanted to read them the relevant part of the Ohio Revised Code that answered that question. And Campbell was okay with that. But Taft objected to it. The judge mulled it over and granted Taft's objection, telling the jury that it wasn't appropriate for him to answer the question because they were supposed to be determining guilt, not sentencing. Taft, and I understand this, he seems to have worried that giving them any option less than hanging would result in a compromised verdict. What he didn't know was that the jury was split at that moment. Some of them wanted to convict. Some of them tended to believe that Peyton was insane, but none of them wanted to risk Peyton being released and going unpunished. So in the absence of an accurate statement of the law, one of the jurors, a bright, well-educated, persuasive man, who I think was acting in true good faith, he assured the other jurors who wanted to convict Peyton that if they found him not guilty by reason of insanity, he would definitely be locked up in an asylum for the rest of his life. Based on this misinformation, they went from being a hung jury to acquitting Peyton on the grounds of insanity.
Unbelievable. What was the process at the time? Being locked up in a 19th century asylum would have definitely been punishment.
It would have sucked. They were brutal. But Peyton couldn't tell you. He never found out. After the acquittal, the case was moved to probate court. That was what the process was. Probate court needed to conduct hearings and decide what to do with Peyton. They could, in fact, have sent him to an asylum for an undetermined length of time. So they could have sent him to an asylum for the rest of his life. But that's not what happened. Through his trials, Peyton displayed odd tics, and he did other physical things that made him look off his rocker. Magically, he lost all those traits during the probate examinations. He was very rational and congenial. He was examined by doctors, including the director of the county asylum, who'd been an expert witness for Taft during the trial, meaning he argued he was sane. And the probate court eventually issued a verdict saying that Peyton was, quote, not now insane, unquote. When the county jailer got the decision and the order to release Peyton, he was genuinely confused. It didn't make sense to him. So he asked the Hamilton County prosecutor what to do. Taft's boss was so disgusted that he sarcastically said, turn him out and give him a pistol. Nobody gave him a pistol, but Peyton did, in fact, walk straight out of the jail a completely free man.
That is just an incredible miscarriage of justice for Nellie, her sister, and the other people who loved her. But it also has to be a huge blow to Taft's ego.
Another of Taft's admirable traits is that he didn't mouth off a lot in public, but he absolutely had to feel humiliated. And this was clearly another deepening of his antipathy to Campbell. You also get a sense of the Inquirer's relationship with Campbell and their coverage of the verdict. Nobody could support the outcome. Nobody. Even Campbell himself, who said that he thought that Peyton should be in an asylum and that the probate court had shirked its responsibility. So the Inquirer called it a great injustice, but it also attributed the verdict to, quote, untiring industry, unquote, of the defense. And that was valid. The public, still to this day, hates and misunderstands the insanity defense. But that was much more true in the 1800s. The public loathed it. Judges didn't believe in it, and neither did juries. Really skilled attorneys always lost with the insanity defense, including Rutherford B. Hayes. And before he became president, Hayes was a really good Cincinnati attorney. And he used the defense with a client who was probably schizophrenic and genuinely should have been found insane. But Hayes lost the case. And when I say that even great attorneys like Hayes always lost, I mean always. T.C. Campbell became the very first lawyer in roughly the 100-year history of Cincinnati to get an acquittal on the insanity defense. And he did it with a client who clearly knew what he was doing and who should have been hanged.
This feels like a case that would really undermine the public's faith in the justice system, kind of like O.J. Simpson or Casey Anthony in more recent times.
Absolutely. It's also one of the cases that deepened distrust of Campbell. How could he get results like this without being corrupt, without bribing juries or tampering with evidence? To me, while I suspect that he did occasionally commit serious ethical violations, I think the answer is that he was simply one of the most brilliant lawyers of the Gilded Age. He was that good. But if you're inclined to think that he's a crook and he conspires with John McLean to rig the justice system, his biggest courtroom successes, like this one, are mounting evidence that the local justice system is systemically broken and that it's being manipulated by an organized ring of corruption led by the guy who gets these verdicts that defy common sense and the newspaper editor who praises the quality of his legal work.
This doesn't follow straight party lines, and none of it is black and white. Halstead's and McLean's newspapers look a lot like cable news channels do today. If you got your news from the Cincinnati Inquirer, it had a heavily unabashed Democratic bent. And if you got it from the Commercial Gazette, it was heavily partisan Republican. But if Tom Campbell is involved in the story, there is a sub-dynamic. The Commercial Gazette is likely to attack him, and the Inquirer will probably come to his defense. Although these are almost purely personal squabbles in 1884, the ongoing catfight between the Commercial Gazette and Will Taft on one side, and the Cincinnati Inquirer and Tom Campbell on the other, will distort news coverage of a murder trial in ways that will help cause the city of Cincinnati to self-destruct.
In the next episode, we're going to tell you about that crime and how it became one of the most infamous and impactful murders in American history.
Until then, if you're interested in diving a little deeper into a famous regional case where Tom Campbell was accused of hiring a former police chief turned sleazy private detective in order to steal evidence from an alcoholic physician, you can read that article in The Bell, The Cad, and the Sex Scandal by Mike in the March 2023 edition of Cincinnati Magazine.
That's it for now. Special thanks to Grab Bag Collab Network for their help on this podcast. And please check out grabbagcollab.com for more podcasts that we think you're really going to love. An additional thanks to our producer and director, Dan Fennessy. We will see you guys next episode.
See you next time.